I'm delighted to have you all online. Mateo Pearson, Matthew R. Pearson, I welcome you in particular, our guest today.
Thank you for
being here. I'm excited, I'm always excited about these live podcasts, but this one in particular. Today we're going to talk about multi-center or multi-site studies. And we'll be talking about at least two kinds. We'll talk about multi-center clinical studies and multi-center survey research kinds of studies. So I thought I'd start with a little fun background. I don't know if you were to guess what the first multi-center study was. I don't know what you would guess, but in fact, the very first multi-center study was a clinical study, and it took place, guess in your mind how long ago, and guess what the study was of, and then I'll tell you. The first multi-site research project was done in the year it was done in the early 40s and reported in 1944, and it was actually published in Lancet, I believe, and it was a study of a drug that, if I'm pronouncing it right, was Petulum. So back in the 1940s, during the Second World War, they continued to conduct medical research, and what they were looking for was the cure for, does anyone want to guess? Does David Eddy want to guess? Medical?
No idea.
Okay. They were looking for the cure for the common cold. How's that? It seems that for a few years in the early 40s, there were some case studies and single-center trials looking for the cure for the common cold. And one of the promising drugs that had come out was this Petulin drug. It's a derivative of penicillin, Petulin. And so a few case studies found it to be effective for the common cold, and a controlled single-center trial found it to be promising, at least. So given the scarce resources during World War II, the Therapeutic Research Corporation approached the Medical Research Council and said, why don't we try to get a lot more people to study? And That is how the first clinical trial began, and it's not a real popular study because, as you might guess, they did not find that particular drug, nor have we figured out since what the cure for the common cold was. So as research on drugs goes, it's not a real well-known study, but like I said, it was the first clinical trial on record, and so I thought it'd be a great way to start off the call, kind of a fun way to get things started. But I was particularly excited about this topic because I've had the good fortune to work with Mateo Pearson and to actually be invited to be one of the sites, and I've actually been the head of an arm of a multi-center study. So I think what we'll do is, why don't we start with Mateo, introduce yourself and where you're from down in New Mexico at CASA, and tell us a little bit about the methods and what the study is. I may say a few words about a clinical trial that I've been involved in the past, and that'll set the stage for talking about the joys and sorrows of trying to run a multi-center trial. So, Mateo, tell us about your work that resulted in over 8,000
sure.
subjects.
Yeah, so I'm Mateo. I'm a research assistant professor at the Center on Alcoholism, Substance Abuse, and Addictions, CASA, at University of New Mexico. I'm really getting that acronym correct nowadays. Got it memorized finally after being here for 4 years. You know, my background really is alcohol research. You know, that's what I've been doing, you know, since early grad school. And I won't go through the whole origin story, but I was really shocked to find the number of gaps in the marijuana field. of things that, you know, you just kind of assume someone's probably done that study before, or someone's obviously figured this out before. And then you go to the literature, and it's like, wow, no one's ever done that before. And my thought was, you know, there's only a few kinds of studies in my mind that answer research questions really quickly. And one of those, and the one we're talking about today, are these kind of large, multi-site, or nationally representative sample kinds of studies. So I had this crazy idea that I should do that, although I didn't have any funding or any knowledge of how to do that. I just started reaching out to people. And really, it's one of those things where probably if I reached out to the first few people and they were all really discouraging, probably would have never happened. But the first few people I reached out to, they were like, oh, my God, it's a great idea. We should do that. And that set me going down this path, and we formed what we now call the Marijuana Outcomes Study Team, which, because, you know, it's a word, most, and if you don't have a good acronym, you don't count. So, but what we set about doing is just saying, well, we don't have money. So really, we set about doing an extremely large pilot study. And the way we're going to do that is by partnering with investigators who are connected to a psychology department participant pool. And that's essentially what we did. I reached out, you know, we ended up with over 20 investigators from 14 different institutions, and 11 of those in our first year collected data. This started last summer. So we collected data from around August, September through May, and we got over 8,000 usable subjects from 11 sites. And I feel pretty confident this is one of the larger pilot studies that one can do with no external funding. And we're making the most of those data, and we're now ramping up for, you know, the second year of data collection. Is that sufficient intro?
Yeah. Hey, how about telling us a little bit more, just so people, I know all this stuff because, like I said, I've had the good fortune of working with you, but why don't you just mention quickly, you did say that it's SONA pool or subject pools, subject pools in these schools. How about just a little more about the instruments we're using, how long it takes to do the survey, the structure, how you've set it up with a portal for all the data to go into one site. It's all part of the mechanics. It's just amazing that you pulled it off.
Sure. So I'm going to mention one more thing before I go into the specific measures. What got me really interested in this is I've been doing protective behavioral strategies work for a while in alcohol, and it came to my knowledge that there'd been a measure created for marijuana. So I was really interested in trying to look at that, but also that looking at kind of campus differences across these sites was a major focus for me. And I thought, you know, just, again, it's kind of anecdotal, so, you know, I wanted to try to test this systematically, is that kind of the quote-unquote typical marijuana user is likely somewhat different in these different locations. And my kind of, I'm just feeding stereotypes here, but, you know, if you're in Alabama or North Dakota using marijuana, you know, you might have somewhat different characteristics than someone who's in, you know, Washington, Colorado, California, where, you know, it's much more prevalent. So I really want to look at that and, you know, be powered enough to actually detect differences like that, that for example, certain traits would be more associated with use in certain places than others. And so in terms of those traits, we have several batteries of kind of personality, impulsivity-like traits, things like that, but also a whole range of kind of belief variables or like normative, you know, descriptive norms, injunctive norms, kind of a newer idea of internalized norms. And I could go on forever about the battery, but what we did do, which is a really good idea, I think, is we made sure that our battery was about 45 minutes long on average, making sure that, you know, most everybody would be able to complete this in an hour. It would be a pretty easy SONA study for someone to sign up for and do. And then I have to give Bruce some credit on this one. One of the things that was really successful is that we standardized it to where literally every site was taking the exact same survey. So that made it, well, we'll get to this a little bit later, but it really made the data cleaning process and everything much less of a hurdle than it would have been if, for example, all 11 sites created their own survey and their own software and things like that. So at each site, the mechanics of it, you know, every site, they sign up for the study in Sona, and they get linked to a site-specific consent form that's hosted at that site. And then that gets forwarded to a generic, you know, basic survey that's copied for all the sites that has, you know, that's identical across the sites. And then that forwards them to whatever the crediting mechanism is at the site. So what we have is a database of all of the main survey entries that's anonymous, you know, totally de-identified, but easily to, you know, put all together and analyze while the studies are being run at all the separate sites and, you know, identifying information, if there were any collected, was hosted at that particular site, which I'm mentioning some of this, and maybe these are some details that people aren't that interested in, but there are alternatives to every one of these choices, and if we had done those alternatives, it would have been a whole lot more work.
Oh no, this is not too detailed at all. It's interesting, you know. It should be mentioned now that there are obvious strengths of doing a study that's large and representative. You know, your size, of course, gives you the power you need to find effects, and then just the breadth of what you're doing. And this is true for multi-site clinical trials. The breadth ensures that you have a good generalizability. You don't just have your university or two universities. One of the funny things about N and our N and our sites is that Mateo called me one day and he said, "Bruce, what's going on in Kansas?" I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "A lot of people get high there, like more than anywhere else in the country." And it was just a matter of, at the time, we had only collected little bit of data from Kansas, and by the time we got into the hundreds here, we obviously were not at the top of the list. We didn't win the contest of which university smokes the most marijuana, most amount of marijuana. So that whole idea of, you know, having results that are generalizable and having numbers that with some power behind them is really important. Did you want to say anything else? I think I'll talk a little bit about the study that I was on that was a clinical trial, just so that to round things out, I won't talk as long as I want you to talk about your study, because mine's history and yours is current and ongoing. But in case there are any questions about multi-center clinical trials, I'd be happy to answer those. So anything else, Mateo, for kind of this introduction?
Go for it.
Okay, good. I should add, as an aside, that Mateo and I are both on IRBs, institutional review boards, and
don't remind me.
Yeah, I'm every you know, we meet every week, but our teams are every other week. So I'm on a team that meets twice a month, and we never, ever, ever have a meeting where there aren't at least a couple of multi-center trials. So in medicine, it's the way to go, unless you're running a pilot study. So that's really status quo in medicine. So anyway, the study I was involved with, I was the head of the cognitive therapy arm of a four-site, three-treatment model study. So we had sites in New Hampshire and in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. And so we had four sites, and we were comparing cognitive therapy to supportive expressive therapy to individual drug therapy. And then ultimately, in the final treatment phase, we added group therapy. And what's interesting here is that Mateo's figured out how to do something as a starter that required no additional funds, just a lot of blood, sweat, and tears on his part. You can only imagine we had we started out with 65 therapists, master's and doctoral level therapists, and there were 20 cognitive therapy therapists, there were 25 supportive expressive therapists, and there were 20 individual drug counseling therapists across all of these sites. And we had to have a massive training phase. The training phase was months long, and we ended up with, okay, so the numbers again were 20, 25, and 20. We ended up with 15, 13, and 12 therapists because it's necessary during a training phase for a clinical trial to simply eliminate, it's not so simply, to eliminate therapists that aren't adhering to the model. So you can imagine we had our therapists supervised by four supervisors. The supervisors, after pretty massive training in one city, we had the supervisors each take on their therapists and listen to tapes and rate the tapes for adherence and competence. And a phone call a week was really necessary to do this kind of training and supervision. So you can imagine what it's like supervising 65 therapists with approximately 16 supervisors. And I don't need to mention that you can imagine that $1 million isn't even enough to pay for a study this big. But as we talk about, what's cool here is when we talk about the challenges, as I watched Mateo run into the challenges that he ran into, they were not that different from a very well-funded, NIDA-funded trial of a clinical multi-center study. So when he would say, I'm having trouble with this or that, it was no surprise. The coordination that's necessary, the collaboration that's necessary, the communication that's necessary. People are enthusiastic at the start, and they say, we'd love to be involved in your study. And then not everybody can produce what they promise they can produce. So anyway, the study, we saw people 18 to 60 years old whose primary diagnosis was cocaine addiction. They could have other addictions and of all drugs and alcohol and nicotine, but the primary addiction had to be cocaine. Ultimately, we saw 487 patients. The results were published in, I think, Archives of General Psychiatry, and our study of training was published in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology. So I'm only saying all this because I'd like to stop here and leave that as a kind of a comparison with a lot of similarities, and also if there are questions about clinical trials and the training and outcome measures and how to fire a therapist that isn't delivering and how to maintain adherence, I'd be happy to answer those things. So with that said, why don't I see if you guys, besides Mateo and I, any questions so far about what we've told you about the methods?
Mateo, this is David from Harvard Medical School. I was just wondering what sort of questions you were asking in your survey, if you could briefly summarize what sort of questions you're trying to answer.
What kind of research questions you mean?
Yeah.
All right, so that's a little more complicated because, which would lead me to describe another process that I felt was necessary to set up. I've been very autonomous and independent in my career, so I haven't done a whole lot of projects until, the last couple of years. Really depend on, other people, and other people are involved with, won't succeed without them. And I'm a little bit shy of the idea that someone else has control over what I do.
Sure.
So I was a little hesitant to this, but we ended up when we set to get, the way we set this up was we set up a publications committee that, that's just members of the team, a smaller subset of the members, that serves to, and any member of the team basically can propose a manuscript idea and say, okay, well,
right,
we need to get this data, we're going to do X, Y, or Z. And, it's pretty standard, probably, other people have done these kinds of things, you disclose kind of, the background of your idea, your hypotheses, what measures you need to do it, and what your methods are going to be. And then the publications committee is tasked with identifying, A, is that, does it overlap with some other planned project? And that's kind of
right.
Job number one, make sure you're not stepping on another investigator's toes. And then, surprisingly, that happens not very much. I expected that would be more of a problem. But so when you say, what are we answering? Well, there were 17, as now there's 17 planned manuscripts using the data. So if you ask me that question, I would tell you what I was most interested in, and which I will in just a second. But you ask another member of the team, you know, they're kind of overall purpose of the study is something else. I think that's kind of important because I'm involved in two other projects right now that are multi-site studies. And, you know, one of them is very constrained. Like, we have a very specific research question we're trying to answer. And we're just bringing on sites, you know, to Bruce mentioned, increase generalizability and basically look at some demographic regional differences that are really hard to look at, you know, with just a few sites. But this one was a little more amorphous, you know, as our first study in terms of there's a whole lot of things. But what I was most interested in, and kind of the papers have reflected that, were these kind of campus differences and to what extent different factors, you know, predict use differently. I mean, and the one example I keep giving, sound like a broken record if anyone's ever heard me talk about this, but is that, you know, if you're in a place where there's low prevalence of any particular drug, insert drug X here, you know, really the people who are going to seek that out are probably like the high sensation seekers, the high impulsivity kind of,
right,
you know, those kinds of people. But if you go something really prevalent, you know,
sure,
caffeine use isn't predicted, you know, strongly by you being some like really highly impulsive sensation seeker.
Right.
I mean, it's just so prevalent that, you know, those characteristics don't seem to be the drivers.
Right.
So the question is kind of, to what extent is it individual difference variables that are driving use? To what extent is kind of environmental, you know, state level, campus level differences? And I'm really interested in identifying different patterns of use. This is a little bit of me going in the soapbox tangentially, but, you know, if you look at alcohol use, there's a lot of binge drinking research, which really kind of makes sense because college students, you know, kind of binge drink. Like, that's something they do. Like, it's a modal form of behavior. And then if you look at daily smokers, you know, a lot of research looks at daily smokers. But, you know, a lot of the marijuana research really focuses on extremes. So, you know, there's famous studies like the Dunedin study and stuff like that. And they're like, well, this is what, this is what happens if you started using early, you continue to use chronically, and you never stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really small percentage of people. So one of the things we really wanted to characterize in this study was distinguishing between more typical, what we'd maybe call like recreational patterns of use versus more problematic, dependent, or cannabis use disorder type patterns of use. So,
right.
And, you know, figuring out, you know, what factors in our battery can account for those differences. You know, like, this typical patterns of use might be predicted by different antecedent variables than kind of the more problematic use.
Mm. Interesting.
I think that answers some of your question, but
yeah, no, absolutely. That gives me a better idea of what you're doing, what you're looking at, and what kind of questions you're asking. That's very helpful. Interesting. Really good.
Mateo, following up on David's question, one of the things that was either let's just say it was brilliant. We could say it was just luck, but let's just say it was brilliant. Is to start this at a time when marijuana is becoming legal in an increasing number of states. So what we have really is sort of a baseline study with only four states allowing marijuana use without it being illegal. So, I mean, this is a tremendous baseline. And I believe you did have that in mind, that the timing was good.
Yeah. So, I guess I didn't really mention it. Maybe I should brag a little bit about our site selection, because we really did want to ensure that we were collecting from states that are kind of fitting in the different categories. So, for example, at the time that we were collecting, or that we started this, really the only fully open recreational legal markets were in Washington and Colorado. So we had sites there. California, as you know, they have medical that quite resembles recreational in many ways. So we had those sites. But, you know, we also had sites. We had North Dakota and Alabama and Virginia, you know, sites that have no form of legal use, or in Texas. We have states that have medical but not recreational, like New Mexico. We have New York. We have Wyoming, Kansas. So I really spent time. I never looked into this in my life, but you know, the census divides the divisions. There's a different division in the United States. Either I think it's divisions or regions. And we had every region represented based on census-based definitions, and we had, you know, the places, like we had a place that's decriminalized with medical, we have the place that's, you know, just decriminalized, we have the place that's everything's illegal, we have places with recreational. And, you know, our idea moving forward is to expand out, and, you know, like obviously now we've got Oregon and Alaska and D.C., and we've got several more states that are on the ballot for November. You know, so just in the next, I mean, it's a really interesting time if you care about this topic, because more or less almost nothing seemed to happen for about 40 years. And not that I remember most of those, because I wasn't even alive for all of those years, but, you know, this was one of those issues that they said, oh, you know, we're almost there. It's almost going to get legalized. You know, people at the time were thinking, oh, we're almost there. Oh, they were wrong. But now it seems like they're not. Like now seems to be a time that the next couple years are going to see truly unprecedented changes in the legalization of marijuana. And, you know, to plug the Research Society on Marijuana a little bit, the reason we founded that is because we really need to have a dedicated outlet, you know, to study these things and, you know, that and to, you know, help along, you know, have scientists at the table, you know, because really – We don't have a whole lot of advice that we can give about how to regulate these markets. You know, Colorado is an example of a state that's had to learn really quickly about some of the pitfalls that come along with legalization. But that's not to say that every state is going to adapt the same way. So, anyway, I'm getting a little tangential.
No, you're absolutely fine. How about some other questions? I know there are multiple people on the line. Anyone? All right. Mateo, what I'd love to have you talk about now is just what it's like to manage what kinds of things besides the publications committee, what kinds of things have you found that make this size project manageable? For example...
Oh, I thought you were going to go the... I thought you were going to go the other way with that.
Well, we will, because you can actually put them together as one, like what makes them manageable and unmanageable.
Sure. So, like I mentioned before, like there's certain things that, let me start at the beginning. When I started this idea, I thought, you know, let's just agree on a core battery, you know, and then every site is going to conduct their own independent study. And then, you know, we're going to have a core battery that, you know, each site's going to de-identify their data, and then they send it to me, and I'll merge all that data together so we can do kind of integrated stuff. And because the time frame, more or less, that I was working with, it became clear that wasn't really going to happen. If I wanted this project to move forward, I was going to have to do more than I kind of anticipated. So, it meant, in terms of challenges, I mean, obviously the biggest thing is 11 sites means 11 IRB applications. And how can I say this not too disparagingly? I haven't seen an IRB application form yet that I look at and I think, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Like, that's so intuitive. It's so intuitive to fill it out this way. That makes a whole lot of sense. So, you know, among, you know, 11 IRB applications, there's about 9 different formats and, you know, the differences in how they, you know, things that have to get submitted. And, you know, to get this project going, the biggest challenge was getting all those in for all these sites. It's an unfunded study. You can't reasonably contact somebody at a site and say, hey, you know, you don't know who I am. I want to do this study. I have big ideas. But here, you got to do all this upfront work for it. So it took a lot of that on in terms of getting these IRB applications done. Now, basically, I learned a lot from that process. I learned that I never want to do that again. But B, that we need to modify the way that IRBs work, probably. So in terms of things that I think we did really well, that, you know, if anyone's thinking about doing this, is standardizing things across site and making it as easy as possible. I mean, my idea really was, look, the way I can de-risk this for people, to where they're not like uncomfortable with joining this team, is to say, listen, you're going to collect your data at your site, and it's your data. Like, you can do absolutely whatever you want with it, right? You own that data. You're the PI. Now, if you decide that you want to combine that data and, you know, with the data collected at all the other universities, you can do that. And, you know, basically I thought there's possibilities more or less to where if the team didn't seem to be working out, let's say I'm just terrible at what I do and you know, in the end, no one wants to work with me. I'm just a dirty word. And no one wants, you know, all wouldn't be lost. They'd still have their site's data and they'd be free to do what they want with it. I'm very happy to say that it hasn't happened and no one's decided to withdraw the data because, again, there's something much more impressive about having 11 sites of 8,000 subjects versus, you know, 300 to 500 at a particular site. So I think that was a way to get people on board, you know, kind of de-risk the whole situation to where, you know, even if all fails, you know, with the team, all is not lost. And but what I think is kind of funny, now I don't know if I'm even answering questions anymore, but something that's really salient in my mind that I learned from this experience was that I really worked hard initially before reaching out to, like, senior investigators to really develop this really good pitch. I was like, okay, I got to develop a really good pitch. How do I sell this? How do I make it sound like they have to do this project, you know? And it was one of those situations where you're selling to somebody who already wants to buy the product, you know? You're just wasting your time. And I'd be 2 to 3 sentences in explaining the project, and they'd be like, oh, this sounds like a great idea. I'd love to be on board. I'm like, wait, I had more of a pitch for that. and the reason I want to mention that is because, again, other than just trying this and doing it, you wouldn't know if people would be open to this, you know? I mean, and I really thought I was going to have to convince a lot of people and work really hard to convince them. And, you know, I can't say that I didn't have to work hard to convince certain people and that there weren't certain issues that had to be addressed, that, you know, the data would be shared fairly and that everybody would be able to contribute their own manuscripts and actually get something out of it. Because some of those issues did have to be addressed, you know, to satisfy, you know, specific PIs. But by and large, everyone was on board. We had one site that had to get dropped for a long story that I won't get into, but they wanted to be on board and they literally just couldn't. But basically nobody that I reached out to said no. Nobody, you know, nobody received the pitch and thought, nah, I don't want to be a part of that study. So I think if you can, you know, dance around and manage some of the pitfalls and, you know, ensure that maybe you can get some help with the IRB applications, for example. I really think this is a more feasible thing than most people would think. And frankly, I spent, you know, 4 or 5 years doing research, and, you know, you've got always the same limitations in every paper you're publishing, you know. Well, the data was collected from one site, or at this site it was, you know, predominantly white, or this site, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, man, I'm just tired of writing that limitation. What can we do about it? You know, like, let's get past that limitation. And in my mind, doing the multi-site study, doing something where we have, you know, every major demographic, we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in that category. You know, something that is not feasible to do. You can't, you know, unless you got every subject at the most diverse school in the country, it's just not feasible to do.
No, you're not.
At this point, I've just talked myself to sleep. No, I don't remember what we're talking about.
Well, you're answering a question that I was asking. You were answering a question about what were the dynamics like, what was it like to go through it and get it started. And so now you're right on target. I hope if there are questions, people will jump right in.
I have a quick question. This is Christine. Were individual sites able to modify the protocol at all? So were they able to add their own individual measures, or did every site have to do the exact same thing?
Yes and no. So for this particular study, one site insisted on they want to. We had, you know, you start with all the measures, and I'm answering your question, but I want to say one more point which is related, because David asked the question about, well, what was the research question? Well, one of the things that I kind of had to give up at the beginning was, I in my head had like 10 different papers that I would want to do using these data. And I thought, wow, if I just propose all 10 of those papers and then tell other people, okay, do you have any paper ideas? I'm really just smothering it. I'm taking everything that I could possibly think of. There wouldn't really be room for other people to, you know, join in. Well, so what it, you know, and a lot of those papers were regarding like alcohol and marijuana use, so comparing different things between alcohol and marijuana. But then as we get further along, it's like, well, we're the marijuana outcome study team, and people are adding additional measures, and we got to a point where the battery was getting way too long. So we decided, kind of as a group, like, well, we can drop these alcohol measures. You know, they're not, you know, necessary for this first thing of the project. And then one of the sites was like, no, I want the extra alcohol measures. And I was like, well, that's going to mean the survey is an hour and a half. And across all the sites, we had agreed, like, we wanted it to be less than an hour. Like, we wanted to be able to give you 1 hour credit rather than an hour and a half or 2 hours. And they said, oh, that's fine. Like, at our site, we'll give them the credit. And it was absolutely no problem at that site. They were able to get plenty of subjects. They were either first or second in terms of recruitment numbers, so they knew their pool. So they had additional measures at that site. The other two projects I'm involved with, each site does have their own measures. So, but what we're doing is, well, one's actually an international study, so the batteries aren't really consistent because one's in English, one's in Spanish, another one's in a different version of Spanish. But the point is there's still some level of standardization. You know, we have one person who's creating the core battery and kind of making copies of that survey and then adding the site-specific measures to it. And that's really the approach that I saw this project, you know, going down. But again, I was really working on this in, you know, July and August of the summer and trying to start data collection in August and September. So we had to rush certain things to get this out there. Given the timing of this, given how important, you know, there's these policy changes that are happening rapidly, I felt pressured, like, we've got to get this study done now. I think it's a good idea to have some site-specific measures. Definitely, you know, keeps that site involved, and they have something that they own that's specific to them. And, you know, there's so many things. In the other project we're doing, there's some things that really, like some measures that really are only going to be given to Native Americans. Because the construct just doesn't make sense to other ethnicities. Well, there's only a few sites that have a high, you know, number of Native Americans in their sites, so those might be site-specific measures. Just an example. Did that answer your question in a really, really long-winded way?
Yes, that was great. Thank you.
Christine, I'd like to add to that, because I've watched from behind the scenes. Mateo is extremely generous, especially when it comes to this particular question. I think, first of all, I probably should say on his behalf that as he put it all together, it wasn't like he came up with the battery all by himself. He was very generous in letting people say, well, I want this in there and I want that in there. So different sites, as he said, could collect data, but of course then they would only have that, unique data, unique to their interest, but then they'd only have data unique to their interest for their site, and they could have done it without the rest of most anyway. But at the, you know, as the study was born, he reached out and, you know, I think continually said, is there something you'd want to have in here? I was interested in political and policy issues, and we put some things in there about political party and stuff like that. for the first most, and I expressed to him now a strong interest, following what we got out of that, I expressed to him a strong interest in just the whole phenomenon of conformity, because some students are complete nonconformists, and they're unconventional, and we try to come up with some strong items that we hope will hang together that will be something of a measure of conformity to social norms. And we looked everywhere for a standardized instrument that would describe those kids in college who, you know, just don't think that they... For a while, we called it the Bernie Sanders types in a very positive way, you know, the ones that want to see change in the world, and they do well. And so we asked questions about their views of actually, what we ended up asking were questions about some political views that we wonder if they will correlate with views of marijuana legalization. So now I feel like, Mateo, hoping I'm answering your question. So as the study's reborn each year, now he's in Most 2.0, those who have been involved really do get input based on what get to have make recommendations and ask for their instruments and ideas to be integrated into the whole multi-center process. And I had a lot of fun working with Mateo on this conformity measure. That would be my part of the answer to that question. Mateo, did you run into any problems where people wanted something where you had to say no, or what did you do when I know there were some recommendations for instruments that were really already in there? They were measuring the same constructs, but just different measures. You want to talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, sure.
Is one of them.
Yeah, we did actually have some overlapping measures for impulsivity and sensation seeking, because they were kind of planned for different types of manuscripts. We have someone who's big into sensation seeking on the team, so he hates all the other sensation seeking measures, probably rightfully so. So he had his own measure. So we certainly it's become more of an issue for our kind of a second portion of this study, you know, where we have like 7 manuscripts out, and 9-10 more in the works, and you know, we answered some of those questions, and we realized the things that we didn't assess so well, and we're adding to the battery, and then here's the battery, and then someone says, well, why don't we add this measure and this measure? And I think, well, hold on, we're already measuring that 2 different ways. What was kind of surprising to me, what I didn't anticipate at the beginning, but certainly understand it has to happen now, is the level of like individual communication with every individual like site PI, or even kind of grad students who are working with them and things like that. Because we really do have people at all levels on this team. And, listservs are great. It's great to send out bulk emails to people. But I'm finding, sometimes the hard way, that that's not the best way to get quick feedback from everybody. So there's a lot of reaching out, and when these issues happen, I just reach out to that individual investigator and deal with it and say, here's what I'm thinking. This seems to have a lot of overlap with that. What's your thoughts? Do you really want this added? Is it really important? And I happen to, I don't know if I've even disclosed this to anybody publicly. This is an exclusive. I didn't add anyone to the team that hadn't been vouched for in some way. Most people are really great to work with, but, there's sometimes people who aren't so great to work with. So I really did, there's no one who, it was just a random cold call. Like I saw a paper they wrote and never heard of them, don't know them. And I think a lot of the smoothness with which this project has gone has to do with the fact that, we have an incredibly collegial, good, friendly bunch of people who, don't get to seem to get bothered so well. Someone just recently, I was on a call, and they said they play nice in the sandbox. And I thought, that's a really great way to describe it. We've got a lot of researchers who play nice in the sandbox, and so a lot of these haven't really become issues. But for this second portion, and this kind of goes back to the original question, which was, you know, this idea of having site-specific measures. It's rare that there's something that you really would just want at your site, right? Like, why wouldn't you want more data on it? Why wouldn't you want, you know, I mean, you can kind of call claim to it and say, here's my measure I'm adding, you know, I want it everywhere. So the site-specific thing's happening a little bit less. But because our battery's gotten so long for a second portion of our project, what we're likely to do is create different versions of the questionnaire. So if you randomize people to different versions, not every subject's answering every question, but you're still getting, you know, a random sample is going to answer all, you know, all the different batteries. And the conversation, which we're not having, we haven't had yet, but we will be having very shortly on a conference call, is which measures really need to be answered by everybody. You know, this is the marijuana outcome study team. Obviously, the marijuana-related questions are going to be answered by everybody, but determining which ones are going to be, you know, answered by a fourth of the sample or a third of the sample is, you know, something we have to do carefully and make, you know, well, again, because everyone's collegial, I don't think it's going to be much of an issue, but I can imagine that could become an issue where somebody's insistent on their measure being answered by everybody, but, you know, other people on the team think, you know, it's not as important to be in the battery, but again, hasn't happened yet. Hope it doesn't happen. But I think selecting your team carefully and, you know, making sure, I mean, there were some people who, you know, I didn't connect with because people who I know and trust told me, oh, you don't want to work with that person or this person. And their names are, no, I'm just kidding.
Hi, this is Sandy from University at Buffalo. I just had a quick question. Hello?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. So I know that this is an unfunded study, so I wondered if you had any idea of how long you plan to be collecting data, or, you know, do you have any plans for adding additional sites or anything like that? I just wonder because you're not really bound by, you know, I have X amount of dollars and X amount of years. So is this something that you see trying to keep going as long as possible or what?
Yes. That was an easy one. No. So there's several things. So we're definitely pursuing funding. We want to take it to the next level. I mean, despite all the benefits of the way we've done this particular study, you know, we can't incentivize participation beyond just credit. So we can't, you know, bring people in longitudinally, have a bunch of follow-ups and things like that. So we're being limited and not being able to get longitudinal data. I'm a big proponent and fan of, is this Sandy Wilson?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So of EMA data. So you're on that.
Yeah, yes, I work
well,
with Lorraine
right?
Collins and Mark Prince.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm a big fan of that. So, you know, the next big, you know, I mentioned like large multi-site studies being one of the, you know, ways to really get the most bang for your buck, especially free. But I also see EMA studies as that way. So some of the things I think in my future are large-scale multi-site EMA studies, and that's actually, you know, what, you know, we're applying for funding for those kinds of things right now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I definitely see more and more teams, you know, me becoming a team builder as much as I can, hopefully build a team and then get somebody else to lead the team eventually so I don't have to do all of it. But yeah, no, I think my goal is to have every state represented and then expand that out internationally. I know we're so focused on the United States, but, you know, big policy things are happening a lot of places. You know, Canada, they basically just had legalization, you know.
Right.
They're about to undergo changes. A lot of countries, you know, are dealing with these things. And we've got countries that have had, you know, decriminalization for, you know, over a decade. We have, you know, countries currently examining it. So I don't really see a limit to where we're going to stop this. Well, right now, I feel we're kind of at like a carrying capacity for the exact way that we're doing it. You know, mm-hmm. we're recruiting, you know, we have a PI at every single site. So typically we have multiple, or we have graduate students at that site as well. And we're using subject pools. So there's a limitation. I mean, a lot of my good collaborators don't have access to a pool like that. You know, they're in medical schools or, you know, postdocs or things like that. So point being, you know, we definitely see growing teams. I don't know if that we'll call it the same thing or not, or if that will be an independent team. But yeah, we're definitely going to keep growing this thing. And if I'm terrible for the rest of my career getting funding, I'll just keep doing this unfunded study each year, and we'll get good, repeated cross-sectional data that we can, still look at some of these research questions with policy changes and things like that.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Mateo, you talked about having 17 planned manuscripts. I know that you're starting to submit some. Is there anything about the feedback you're getting from submitting manuscripts, assuming that, like the rest of the world, you don't just get every manuscript you submit accepted without revisions? Are you hearing anything that is influencing your approach, your choice of instruments, or anything like that?
Well, yeah, actually, I don't want to brag, but, you know, all of these manuscripts are being accepted without revisions. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, right.
No.
How come I don't have one on my resume yet, then, my CV?
Because I'm too busy to revise them.
Oh, no, that's not right.
We have too many revise and resubmits that all came in at the same time. That's the problem with, like, writing 5 papers in 2 weeks, is all the revise and resubmits come at the same time, too. We're not really getting any kind of consistent criticisms. I don't think across what we've submitted, we've gotten pretty consistent positive feedback. I've now presented research from this team in at least 3 different conferences at CPA, APS, APA. Yeah, I think it was 3. Oh, and WPA. So 4 different conferences we presented this. It seems like every time I call this a pilot study, everyone laughs. Because it's like, what? A pilot study with 8,000 subjects? But it's like, well, you know, if our goal is 100,000 subjects nationally, 8,000 subjects is a pilot study. We're really getting positive feedback from everybody. I mean, there's limitations. We're collecting cross-sectional study data from psych pool majors, right? There's definitely a better way to do this. But I haven't figured out a better way to do it quickly and this efficiently.
Gotcha. Other questions? We're getting close to the end, but we're not exactly there yet. Other questions? I was thinking that if anyone on the call is intrigued by the idea of doing a study that won't cost anything, at least it won't mandate a major R01 or R21. If anyone's thinking about that, one of the easiest ways to start, not quite out of the gate as fast as Mateo, is just one university at a time. We're piloting an instrument here that we have hundreds of we're looking at reliability and validity data. We've got hundreds of responses, but they're all from the same university, and we have a sense of what we need to do with that instrument now, and it's ready to be piloted at other places. And I'm surprised at how few people ask each other, would you consider running this at your school, at your program, in your community? You really got a fast and mighty start with 11 universities, but even multi-center includes more studies that include more than one setting. Again, I'm surprised that we don't see more of that, because it's pretty rewarding. Any other challenges you came across that you want to mention before you say goodbye to us? Any challenges with personnel or with deciding on credit for publication? I mean, you have a you have a lot of decisions to make at every point in time.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're kind of hitting the major ones. I mean, for that first project, the major challenge was, you know, learning every university's IRB system and, you know, doing a lot of the work. I really think if you give yourself enough time to do this, people are willing to help out and do more of those things. I was on a kind of weird timeline. But, you know, moving forward, again, I'm revising that approach. You know, this next team that we're developing, which is going to be larger and in a somewhat different area, really. But it's, you know, we're shooting for spring and we're forming the team right now and working on IRB stuff right now. So we have plenty of time between now and then to really flesh this all out before we go. But it's funny, I forgot a lot of these concerns because it was over a year ago that I recruited all the people for most. But, you know, the major concerns people have is, you know, am I really going to have a say-so? Like, am I really going to have a, you know, am I really going to be able to get out anything of this personally? One of the things that we decided to do was, you know, every manuscript that comes from the combined data is we're going to have a corporate authorship of the marijuana outcome team. And the publications committee, you know, kind of serves to ensure that these publications are accurate and that we're never going to be publishing, like, contradictory results, contradicting ourselves or anything like that. And again, like making sure like all the papers are not too overlapping and, you know, we're not doing like salami publications or anything like that. But yeah, I think informing this other team, it reminded me, I mean, some of the concerns to begin with were, you know, really, am I going to be able to have my piece? And then honestly, the major way that it happened was I dropped a bunch of things that were kind of like my things that I wanted to look at. And I was reflecting on this a couple weeks ago, thinking about, you know, how different the battery would have looked like if it was just me deciding what went in the battery and if it was the full team. Well, it would have been very different, the battery would have been, but, man, we wouldn't have been able to answer so many of the research questions that we're answering right now. So, you know, if anybody's listening and they're super independent, they like their, as one of my colleagues like to say, control enthusiasts, not a control freak, but a control enthusiast. There's great benefit. I mean, team science really is the way to go of the future. This is where we're going. You really can't do it all alone. And as somebody who's like really thought that way, that I can do everything alone, it took stepping back and saying, you know what, I'm going to have to let this go, to make room for people to enter the battery. And basically that same exact thing is now happening for our international study, and it's happening for the study for the spring, where, you know, I'm dropping some of the measures that I was anticipating using, but adding measures that I didn't even know about. One of the team members just created a measure. It's not even published yet, and it's fascinating. It's like, oh, I'd love to collect that, you know, across the sites, you know. So it's great to have colleagues. It's great to have collaborators. And honestly, I feel like I quadrupled my number of colleagues just by doing one study. So I really would recommend it. And anyone who, if you want to talk about anything offline, or if you're like listening to this on the website days, weeks, months, years from now, I can be contacted at mateo.pearson@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Let me just repeat it to make sure everyone heard it. Mateo, mateo.pearson, P-E-A-R-S-O-N, @gmail.com. All right, Mateo, thank you. Those of you who have called in, thank you. We've run out of time. Again, this is the Division 50 Society of Addiction Psychology sponsored activity, this live podcast. And it's wonderful to hear those of you who have called and asked questions, as well as those who join us. And in the very near future, we'll have our new website, and we'll also be posting these podcasts on there. So thank you.
Thank you for a fascinating talk, Mateo, and thank you too, Bruce.
Yes, thank you.
So welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for the questions.
Always fun. We will we'll be back next month.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Bye.